talk about taking the romance out of online dating. Jeez.
But isn't that... Coming up this week on The Week in Geek, the Seattle City Council is considering a tax on Amazon and other high-earning companies in the city, and the conflict over it got nasty this week. We will explain everything on this week's show. Plus, a Seattle-based startup wants to give you doctor's appointments from your smartphone with help from an AI chatbot. From GeekWire.com in Seattle, I'm editor Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg, Civic Innovation Editor.
I'm Life Sciences Reporter and Podcast Producer Claire McGrain.
All right, so Monica, you just got back from downtown Seattle where there was really a big conflict between iron workers and Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, really clashing over a giant issue. So in a minute, I want you to describe that scene. But first, let's explain how we got here, because tempers were running over this week, and I think it's important for people to understand the underlying issues. The head tax, which is probably the wonkiest, most boring term that you can imagine. What is it? Why does it matter? And why are people so upset about it?
Yeah, it's funny to see so much intense debate and passion over something as boring as a tax. But it's not boring to the stakeholders, not boring at all. And how we got here is... Seattle is dealing with an unprecedented homelessness problem. We have the third largest homeless population in the country, and Seattle is not the third largest city in the country, so it's really a galling issue. And the city council believes that we need to raise a lot more revenue to deal with it, to build affordable homes for people experiencing homelessness and homeless services. So they are using one of the few tools they have in their toolkit and have proposed the head tax, which is about 26 cents per employee per hour worked for companies grossing more than $20 million a year. So those are a lot of confusing numbers, but what it basically means is the companies in the city that make the most money, the top 3% of companies, will be on the hook for this tax that would go to fund homeless services and affordable housing.
And so what does that mean for Amazon? Because Amazon makes billions and billions upon billions of dollars. So, you know, cents, what does it matter?
In terms of Amazon's bottom line, it is not very significant. In terms of Amazon's relationship with its hometown, it's incredibly significant, and that's where this announcement came from, I think. Amazon has been growing aggressively in Seattle, and it's become sort of emblematic of a lot of the growing pains that Seattle's experiencing, from homelessness to traffic to a myriad other things that Amazon or the tech industry are often blamed for. Now, you can debate how true that is, but I think that there is a feeling of not being appreciated in the city that Amazon has grown in and provided so many high-paying jobs in. And when you combine this announcement that they're going to pause construction on one of their new office buildings and reconsider moving into another one with their search for a second headquarters, you have to start to think, are they feeling like Seattle isn't the best place to call home right now?
Yeah, so you're alluding to this announcement. So let's talk about what caused that, exactly what it was, and what it means going forward. So Amazon said on Wednesday that they were pausing all construction on one project that they're building, a new expansion in Seattle. It's called Block 18. And that is essentially, I believe, the fifth block of their new second headquarters in the Denny Triangle. Am I getting the real estate details right there?
I believe so, yeah. And as you mentioned, it's not that they're pausing all of their construction in Seattle. They still have several projects that are underway, but they are pausing this one building. And then there's Rainier Square, another big office development. And they're saying that they might sublease that to a different company instead of occupying it.
And they were explicit. They are doing this pending the outcome of the head tax vote. So here is where you really get into it. Amazon is essentially either playing a big bluff or just saying, hey, we're fed up with this. What's going on here in terms of this kind of high stakes gamble, it feels like?
Well, that's the big question. Is it a political maneuver designed to influence the city council's vote, which is expected May 14th, although there are some rumors that that might be delayed now amid all of this controversy? But those that I've spoken to said that, or at least those in the business community said that they've never known Amazon to be a bluffer, or even one to really tip its hat about what it's going to do in advance. So the fact that they are doing this, those in the business community say should be taken seriously.
The implication, at least, is that Amazon will not grow in Seattle to the extent that it was planning if the city goes forward with this tax, and more broadly, if the city, in Amazon's view, continues to be anti-Amazon. Is that the gist?
I think that is the gist. And whether or not Amazon slows or stops its growth in Seattle, I think what you can take away from this is, even if $20 million might seem like a drop in the bucket to a company that makes billions in annual profits, Amazon is watching this very closely, and they are having a very strong response to it, even if it doesn't impact their bottom line in a big way.
All right. So that is the backdrop for this event that you went to today, where Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant was planning to talk to reporters about the head tax plan. Let's listen to what happened.
No head tax! 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 No.
All right, Monica, describe that scene.
It was dramatic. It was intense. You know, it was a crazy hot day for May in Seattle, combined with crazy hot tempers, and emotions were flying. You had the Seattle Ironworkers, the local union, shouting over Shama Sawant, who was trying to implore her colleagues not to back down on this tax. So she called this presser in response to Amazon's announcement about slowing its growth in Seattle. And she wanted to get the message out there that this is a threat, that we shouldn't back down, that this is even more important because Amazon is being a bully. That's her message. But that message got really lost because this union and other people came out to really yell over her and express frustration with the council.
It's an interesting juxtaposition because typically Shama Sawant is very much on the side of unionized workers. And so you have a clash here of interests, really.
That's right. She's a socialist. And you really saw that play out where she felt like she didn't know what to do. She invited the iron workers to speak several times. She really didn't want to be in a position where she was fighting against them. But when she did eventually have the opportunity to address reporters, she said, this is the game. This has always happened in a capitalist society. Big corporations pit workers against workers.
It was interesting. She did something that I thought was really smart. They invited the leader of the protest to come up and speak.
They did. And at first he didn't want to, but eventually he did take them up on that. But yeah, another thing that's important to note is that not all workers are of one mind on this. Shama Sawant had several workers in the technology industry there to speak, and one member of this same union who was there to speak out in favor of the head tax. And, he, you know, bless his heart, he did it. But it was really, it looked like it was a challenge for him because his coworkers were shouting over him and jeering and yelling his name.
All of this is against the backdrop of Amazon's HQ2 search, which makes it all the more fascinating because here you have Amazon going out to cities around the continent and saying, hey, we want to bring these same types of high-paying jobs that we have in Seattle to you. And one of the things that they're asking for is tax breaks. And here you have the city council in Seattle going the other way. I thought it was really interesting what Richard Florida said on Twitter this week. Can you explain who Richard Florida is?
He's probably as close as you can get from being an urbanist celebrity. He's a scholar, but he's very well known, and he's an editor at large for City Lab, and he writes about cities and urban issues.
And he has been very outspoken about the rights of cities in this whole Amazon search and saying to cities, hey, don't give away the farm to get these 50,000 jobs. Not the best analogy for this high-tech scenario, but he wrote on Twitter after Amazon announced that it was going to be freezing some of this development, disgusting and disgraceful. Hey, progressive mayors, watch and learn. Your Amazon HQ2 city is next. If they put the screws to your hometown like this, imagine what they'll do to yours. It's fascinating because that is not the view in these cities. These cities are doing everything they possibly can, and I can understand why they are. This is a giant economic development prize, a $5 billion campus, 50,000 jobs. Any mayor would be crazy not to go after that, right? I mean, how do you square these things?
I think it's a big challenge. I think cities are in a tough position because the prize is so big and they don't want their constituents to ask why they didn't bid for Amazon. But I really feel like elected officials have a responsibility that companies don't have. Companies are in the business of business. They're going to maximize their profits and be as competitive as they possibly can within whatever the regulatory structure and environment is. Elected officials are responsible for creating a regulatory structure that's responsive to their constituents. So when you think about like where the responsibility lies, I mean, I think you could slice this a million different ways and it's a tricky situation, but that's my two cents.
I think this is a really interesting kind of microcosm of Amazon, Seattle's leadership, civic leadership, and then the constituents that live in Seattle and how they're all interacting with this. It's a really interesting example of how the relationship between Amazon and Seattle has gotten to where it is today. It seems like it's just constant escalation and no working together.
It certainly feels like it's reaching a boiling point, and the stakes are very real. Amazon is going to build another headquarters somewhere else. Amazon announced this week, and I don't think it's a coincidence because I don't think anything they do is a coincidence, that they're adding 2,000 jobs in Boston and 3,000 jobs in Vancouver. And they want people to know that they have options. They have really good options from these cities that are offering billions in incentives. So the clash with Seattle, with Amazon's hometown, has very real and high stakes, no matter where you stand on it.
I also wanted to ask a little bit about the issue that's kind of unspoken in all this, and that's Seattle's huge homelessness issue. As you said earlier, we have the third largest homeless population in the country, even though we're far from the third largest city in the country. And so thinking, if I was in the Seattle City Council's shoes, if I was sitting on that board and I had to make decisions for this city and solve this problem, how do you do it? Like, how do you do it without just creating more affordable housing?
Can I be the voice of reason here?
Absolutely.
I think Amazon needs to step up. I do not think it's enough for a company that has made this big of an impact on the city to simply say, we're taking our marbles and we're going home if you're not going to play with us. I think Amazon's actual constructive response would be to say, and this is not entirely fair for a reason I'm about to explain, but would be to say, hey, let's get together. We've got some of the smartest minds on the planet working on some of the biggest challenges in the world. Let's solve this thing together. We're going to come up with an Amazon solution to this homeless problem here. Now, here's the reason that's not entirely fair. Amazon actually has done things like putting a homeless shelter for families in one of its future homes. So to be fair, that's it. But why can't the company step up and go, let's change the game. Let's change the conversation. You don't need to tax us. We're going to help you fix this. Well, is that unreasonable?
Well, there are a lot of people who feel the way that you do, including Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda, who I spoke with. She's one of the sponsors of the tax. And she said, we invited Amazon to this discussion a long time ago and they boycotted, which is true. The Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce and Amazon and other businesses boycotted the deliberations about what the head tax should look like because they felt like from the beginning the outcome was predetermined. They're going to tax business and we don't want to be a part of that. So I can understand her logic that now making this announcement is kind of, you're complaining about something that you didn't participate in.
Right, but I understand why Amazon didn't want to participate in the head tax discussion. I think there should be a larger discussion that Amazon takes part in, and maybe there are these discussions happening, but it certainly isn't coming out in this whole discussion, that's about the homelessness challenge. If that's what the problem is that the city council is trying to solve with this head tax, are we adults or children? What are we? I mean, seriously. They're acting like children, all of them.
I think that that's a fair point.
I also wanted to jump back to something you said, Todd. I think it is totally fair that Amazon in recent months and years has been stepping up its philanthropy. They are, as you said, partnering with Mary's Place, putting a shelter for homeless women and families, in their new building. But that is a band-aid. Like, the homelessness problem in Seattle is huge. And the problem, people will have many, many kind of things to say about homelessness, perhaps not all of them well informed, but a huge number of those people, maybe less than 50%, but still a huge number of people who are homeless have full-time jobs. They just simply cannot afford a place to live, or they're struggling with mental illness or addiction, something that means that they cannot have a stable income for the time being. There's ways that they could get back to doing that. But again, basically, my point is, there's no way to solve that problem unless there is affordable housing. And obviously, the market isn't creating affordable housing by itself. So I understand why the city council would feel a responsibility to step in and try and do that, even if this does not seem like maybe the best way to go about it.
And to be clear, I'm not saying it's Amazon's obligation to solve the problem. And I'm not blaming Amazon for the problem. Certainly, the overall economic climate and the growth that we've seen, they've been a big part of it. And that has led to or at least contributed to the problems that the city council is trying to solve with this tax. I'm not blaming them, and I'm not saying they're obligated, but I'm saying, wouldn't it be cool if somebody could step up and be the bigger person here? Why not Amazon? Why not show it here? And also, that could be a great demonstration to counter what Richard Florida is saying to the HQ2 people.
Do you think they would actually do that, given what you know about the character of the company and kind of their goals and values?
I guess not.
Oh, no.
I think it's interesting, though.
Based on past behavior, not necessarily, unfortunately. I guess maybe I'm just a sucker. I'm an optimist. I want people to evolve and get better and come on.
Step up when there's such an obvious problem to be dealt with. Yeah.
And why do you have to? I don't think that the Seattle City Council is doing the right thing here, and I don't think Amazon is doing the right thing here. And it's disappointing. It's really disappointing because we live here in Seattle, and I realize not everybody who listens to the show on the podcast especially is from here, but we live here in one of the coolest places on earth. It's amazing. There are world-changing things happening here. Let's change them for the better. I'm running for mayor.
I'd vote for you.
joke.
I would vote for you, though, and not just because you're my boss.
Really? After working with me, you would you should take that back.
Well,
in theory.
Let's change the subject. Back to the original subject. I mean, I do think a fascinating part of this whole battle is how much each side seems to be digging their heels in more whenever a development happens. Like, there has been growing tension between the city council and Amazon for years, and it felt like it came to a head with the Amazon HQ2 decision. Like, wow, they're looking elsewhere, and it seems at least in part a response to the climate here. And from that, rather than singing a more collaborative tone, the city council turned to the head tax, which felt like an escalation there. And then Amazon, which I think, at least from a recruiting point of view, is concerned about its reputation, rather than coming up with a solution like you suggested, comes out with this, I mean, it's a threat. Let's call it what it is. It's a threat to slow its growth in Seattle. So I'm not very optimistic that a collaborative approach is in the future, although Mayor Jenny Durkan said that she is going to convene all the stakeholders to try to come up with some sort of compromise, and she does have veto power over the bill, even if it passes, if the head tax passes. So that's one area that hasn't really been explored yet.
So what's next?
Well, it sounds like it's possible that the vote will be delayed, although the May 14th vote and the current version of the head tax is the latest of many. And last year, it was narrowly voted down with the promise to revisit it this spring, by no later than this spring. So I think that there's definitely a sentiment among a lot of the council members that they just need to get this done. They're burning through a lot of political capital. This is an ugly fight, and it's not doing anyone any favors.
And it's going to raise $75 million a year.
It would raise about $75 million annually. Amazon would be on the hook for about $20 million annually. But in 2021, it would change to a payroll tax.
Okay. All right. Well, we can discuss that later.
Another quick number. I was curious about this, so I looked it up. The number of homeless people in the King County area, so the area around Seattle, is about 10,000, about 3,000 in Seattle itself. The Mary's Place shelter that Amazon helped them build after their previous shelter was knocked down for Amazon's building is about 300 beds to sleep homeless people. I couldn't find a number for what the final shelter in Amazon's headquarters is going to be, but I would assume it's about the same size. So yeah, about 10% of Seattle's homeless population.
Yeah, I've had some interaction with the Mary's Place folks. Wonderful organization. And I don't mean to diminish what they're doing or Amazon's efforts there, but let's think big picture and solve this thing. That's where I am.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Getting off my soapbox. There's a cool Amazon new service coming out that I want to talk about later in the show.
Oh, gosh.
We'll do that coming up on The Week in Geek. Stick around.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Fred Hutch Obliteride, a fundraising bike ride and 5K walk to raise millions of dollars with the goal of curing cancer faster. Scenic routes for all levels of riders include 25-mile, 50-mile, and 100-mile rides, plus a 5K walk. Be a superhero and invest in Fred Hutch scientists to end cancer once and for all. Obliteride takes place August 11th. Registration and info at obliteride.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Claire McGrain.
Claire, you covered a really interesting story this week about a new company. Well, the company isn't new, but the service is new. They finally unveiled what they're doing. by a longtime entrepreneur that a lot of people have been wondering what he's going to be up to. His name's Robbie Cape. What did he do in the past?
He sold his previous company, which was called Cozy, to Time Inc.
Yep.
For a lot of money. I don't think the number was disclosed. He also spent 12 years at Microsoft.
And the Cozy was an app for families to do organizing and that sort of thing. Well-known entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Scheduling. So his new app is called 98.6. So I assume it has something to do with healthcare.
It does have something to do with healthcare. Boy, howdy, does it.
So what's he doing?
So they had been kind of giving hints at what they were doing, and it was only this week that they fully announced it. 98.6 is an app. So you can go to the App Store right now, download it. If you pay them a subscription amount, so for right now, for their launch, it's $20 for a year. Later, it'll be $120 for a year. You have unlimited access to a doctor through your smartphone. So you can have a doctor's appointment to get something diagnosed, get a prescription, et cetera, all on your smartphone. And they're able to do that thanks to, get ready for all the buzzwords, artificial intelligence chatbots.
It's like back in the day when somebody wanted to have a really successful company, they just put .com on it.
Yeah.
Now they just say AI.
Yeah, yes.
Or blockchain.
Yeah. Ooh, blockchain. That's the
new. Blockchain is the new one, yeah. But this is actually really interesting. It's an application of AI that, to my mind at least, makes a lot of sense. It takes basically the administrative tasks that doctors would do out of the equation. So when someone pulls their phone up, they'll start chatting with a chatbot. And the chatbot has been trained to ask them what they're coming in for, know what kind of follow-up questions to ask to get the information that the system needs. So, for example, if I have like an earache, it might ask me, you know, how long have you had an earache? Have you had earaches in the past? Have you taken prescription antibiotics for earaches in the past? Stuff that, like, you just need to get that information.
It's the digital equivalent of the physician's assistant who comes in before the doctor comes in.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And then it passes the conversation off to a doctor who's given, through a different set of technology, kind of a spreadsheet of the information you have just told the chatbot. And then the doctor is able to diagnose and give you a treatment plan. And so the interesting thing is, right now, the doctor is in charge of, you know, giving you your plan, telling you where your prescription is going, making sure the prescription gets there. But over time, Robbie Cape told me, they're going to try and have the doctor do less and less and less till the doctor is literally only looking at symptoms, making a diagnosis, deciding on the treatment, and then leaving the conversation, and the chatbot does the rest of it.
Really interesting. So they started rolling this out this week.
Yeah, they've been doing a limited beta in a few different states, and this week it is available in 10 states. So if you are in California, Connecticut, Florida, Michigan, Maryland, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, or Washington.
Oh, Washington.
Washington, yes. Well, they're based here.
Is there a particular hospital or system or doctor? Or?
So here's the thing. They're partnering with certain organizations, so their organizations will pay for their employees to be able to use this, but anybody can download it. So you don't have to be with a certain hospital. You don't have to have insurance. None of that. You can just go and download it like you would get a Netflix subscription.
All right. So you're essentially going through 98.6 to its doctors through the app.
Yeah. It employs all of the doctors that give patients treatment through the app right now. And I believe their plan is to continue doing that. And they're planning on expanding to all 50 states and Washington, D.C. by the end of the year, which is pretty ambitious. So we'll see how they do on that.
How do they make money?
So Robbie's whole thing is making doctor time as efficient as possible. So when you go to like a primary care clinic, the reason it's so expensive is because you have a person checking you in, a person taking all that information, a doctor checking on you, maybe a person checking you out or giving you a prescription. You have a physical location. You have all these medical supplies there that you don't really need or use most of the time anyway. So stripping all of that away and really just maintaining the most efficient way to get care is what they're all about.
Okay. So that is 98.6. You can check it out at 98, spelled out, right? Is it?
It's so the number 9, the number 8, the word point, and then the number 6.
.com. Okay. 98.6.
Or download it if you're interested in trying the service on kind of any iOS or Android device.
Okay. My last item here of news that struck me this week, Amazon came out with something called the Prime Book Box.
Oh, ho.
So Amazon, of course, popularized the wireless delivery of electronic books. This is all about the old-fashioned delivery of physical books. You can subscribe as a family to receive a curated selection of kids' books every 1 month, 2 months, or 3 months. It's $23 a box. So it's basically a new subscription service from Amazon. But the reason I found this story so interesting is there are bookstores, physical bookstores out there that do this. So Amazon is essentially cutting off the knees of these indie bookstores again. I guess it's not a feel-good story.
You know, they also started doing their Prime Wardrobe service recently, which is like this and the Prime Wardrobe are very similar to services like Stitch Fix, which is the same thing but for clothes, basically.
Now, the Prime Book Box is a little bit different. You basically, you get the books and you're buying them, whereas things with like Prime Wardrobe, you get a selection, you try them on, and you send back what you don't want. You can opt not to get specific books in the app if you already have them before they send it. Almost like I'm in the Dollar Shave Club and you tell them, oh, I don't need razors this month. So you go in the...
Gotcha.
That kind of thing. So, but it's a really interesting subscription service. But we talked with a independent bookstore in San Carlos, California, called The Reading Bug. And they've done The Reading Bug Box for several years. And it's very similar... Uh-huh. And it's in some ways it's good for them because all of a sudden there's all this attention being paid to this model, and I'm sure they've gotten new subscriptions this week. But at the same time, here comes Amazon competing with them. So.
Yeah, it seems like Amazon is really trying to get into that space of very convenient but still like personalized, tailored, recommended kind of thing. And it'll be curious to see how well they do that transition.
Yeah. I'm very tempted to sign up for it, though. I'll tell you, it's like it's the two minds, you know.
It's only for kids' books, though, right? So it'd be for your daughter.
I asked if they were planning to do this for adults because I think that would be really cool if they have a curated selection of adult books in a certain genre that you like, and they wouldn't tell me.
So I guess it depends on how good the curation is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, so that is the Amazon Prime Book Box. You have to be a Prime member. It is not, however, a free Prime perk. Let me do something here. For now, the service is available only via invitation, which is why that indie bookstore that I mentioned with the Reading Bug Box
is getting more subscriptions.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I hope so.
All right. We will be right back with the Random Channel. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It is time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week where we talk about all the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes this week. Monica, I know what your item is, and I was buzzing about this too because it was a real head scratcher.
It was very weird. Should I explain it or
please.
Should you?
No. Yeah, because please.
Okay. So Facebook had its F8 Developers Conference this week, and I think people were watching a little extra closely because of all of the scandals that Facebook has been enduring over the past few months, most visibly the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which had to do with data sharing and user privacy. Interestingly, the biggest headline out of at least the portion of it that I watched was that Facebook is launching a dating app. Which just the dissonance was really amazing there of like users are confused and outraged about how our privacy and our data is being used. But here's a dating app.
That's exactly how I felt as well. It was like, could you have thought of anything more bizarre?
So it's a new dating service simply called Dating, and it's going to be available within the Facebook app, almost like the shopping tab inside the Facebook
app. Right, Marketplace is that area where you can buy and sell stuff. Yeah, it's going to be part of the Facebook app. Mark Zuckerberg said it's for meaningful relationships, not for hookups. I don't know how he's going to police that, but...
Hey, you!
Knock it off. That's not what this is for.
Yeah. It's the fear of Mark Zuckerberg showing up on your date that keeps you in line.
Which is so funny when you think back to FaceMash and all the shenanigans he got up to in his dorm room when he pre-Facebook.
Right, because the predecessor to Facebook was like a Hot or Not app.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's basically returning to his roots. But you're right, what a weird moment to do this.
Super weird. Yeah, I'm very curious what those meetings were like about making this big reveal at F8. Like, was it just... to come out with something totally different and change the narrative. It seems a little bit strange to be dealing in something so personal as dating while immersed in this much bigger controversy about privacy.
So Tinder and Bumble, RIP?
I don't know. Match Group, which owns Tinder and OkCupid, saw its share price sink on the news to be... determined how much the feature is used on Facebook, I guess.
I think it's kind of a smart move by Facebook because they have so much information about you, as we are all learning. They probably know how to match you well. Well, they know enough about you to match you well, but I'm skeptical that they would do the matching particularly well, because that's not super their strong suit. And I don't know that people are actually going to trust them at this point. Like, the Facebook brand is not the one that you want. It's not like a sexy brand. Like, it's not what I would
get. I think it used to be. I don't think it is anymore. I think when it first came out, though, it was very cool and sexy. And the fact that they had that, like, relationship status, it's complicated. Interested in men, women, or both. Like, those things are were very key features early on. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. It's interesting because, like, Tinder, I think, relies on the Facebook API to operate. And it uses your friends of friends to find you matches. And Facebook has said that it's going to do something similar. It won't connect you if you're using the dating feature with your friends, but I think friends of friends are allowed.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, so they say that Facebook will use a unique algorithm to match you with potential dates based on dating preferences, things in common, and mutual interests. But your regular profile and your dating profile won't interact. In other words, your friends won't see all your, well, not your hookups, I guess, Zuck, but whatever, your substantive coffees.
Your meaningful dates, yeah.
So it's opt out, right? So it's not just going to start, Facebook isn't just going to start,
that's a good,
like,
question,
sending me dating recommendations.
It's opt in, I think.
You have to opt into it.
Yeah, and one interesting integration, though, is that it sounds like Facebook will, once you've made a match, recommend events.
Oh.
Facebook events.
That's kind of a good idea.
Later on, they extend it to the commerce tab and recommend the things that you and your
baby own your whole life. Yeah.
Yeah, but so Facebook has this robust events app within its larger Facebook app. So they'll connect people and say, like, hey, we matched you. You should go check out this event based on your interests. And I think that people who are using the dating feature who go to events will be able to see other people who have the feature turned on and meet them there. So there's a lot of integrations here that are very interesting.
Talk about taking the romance out of online dating. Jeez.
But isn't that...
I miss the good old days of Match.com. So romantic.
But, like, if you're being, like, digitally matched with someone, at least you get to choose what you're doing together.
Claire, you're showing your age.
Oh, my God. Oh, hilarious. That's hilarious. I was going to say something, but I totally forgot what it was.
Sorry.
Well, what else? Anything else on that?
Random channel.
Okay. So I had a, talking about random, guess where Verizon had its shareholders meeting this past week?
I have no idea.
Renton, Washington. This was a really weird thing. I got to go down and interview the CEO of Verizon Communications, the guy who runs the whole shebang, Lowell McAdam. Very interesting interview. I'm going to post the transcript on GeekWire. But it was fascinating for me because this was 3 days after T-Mobile and Sprint announced plans to merge. You can hear all about that in our Geared Up podcast on GeekWire. And I got to talk to him. The first thing I noticed was we sat down in this conference room at this really swanky hotel in Renton. And I noticed I could basically see T-Mobile headquarters over the trees. And so I said to him, like, hey, man, did you do this? I can, like, see John Ledger over there. I can almost see John Ledger on the other side of the mountain. And he said, Lowell McAdam said, is that where the hot air is coming out of?
Sick burn, Lowell.
At any rate, it was an interesting interview and a fun experience to be able to sit down and talk with the CEO of Verizon about everything from net neutrality to 5G to T-Mobile and Sprint. And Monica gave me a lot of good questions on net neutrality. He had some good answers.
Yeah, I want to know what he said about net neutrality.
Basically, his point was he's okay with net neutrality staying in place because that's what they do anyway. And his problem with the states imposing their own individual net neutrality rules after the repeal by the FCC is that it's unpredictable. Do you buy it?
That's what the ISPs are saying in general. And I think that the problem there is that many of them had their lobbying organizations really push for the FCC to repeal net neutrality. I totally understand that they don't want a patchwork of state laws because compliance with that is a nightmare and that businesses hate uncertainty. But I think it's a very easy position for them to take now that net neutrality at the federal level has been repealed.
All right, Claire, rescue us from the world of telecommunications.
Well, have I got a fun time for you. So I'm a huge fan of this podcast called In the Dark. Their first season really dove deep on this kidnapping that happened in the 1980s. A boy called Jacob Wetterling in the Midwest disappeared, was kidnapped at gunpoint, actually, in his small rural town. And they go through the case and really try and figure out what happened, why it took law enforcement so long to find the killer, which they eventually found just before the podcast started being released. It's a very dramatic opening to a podcast, but it's very well reported and very well told, very engaging story. They just launched their second season. This time it's in a small town in Mississippi where there was a really brutal quadruple murder. 4 people were killed. This man who lived in the town has been tried for that crime 6 times, and every time has been convicted or the jury has been hung. And only the first 2 episodes are out, but the reporter who does this podcast really digs into what's going on here, and she is pulling no punches. She's very critical of a lot of people involved in the investigation. And again, just very well told, really interesting set of characters that you get to meet. So I wanted to recommend that.
So it's called?
In the Dark.
Okay. And second season just started.
Just started, yeah. So you can binge listen to the first season, and by the time you're done, the second season will be done.
Do you need to have listened to the first season to listen to the second?
No, they're completely different stories, okay. But I would recommend listening to both of them if you're interested at all in kind of crime drama or good narrative podcasts.
I love crime drama. I'm very excited to listen to it.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody needs to do a podcast on the whole Golden State Killer thing. Did you follow that
whole
thing?
Yes. I want to see a movie on that.
Oh, yeah. That's
true. So this is really interesting because the Golden State Killer was eventually arrested because of DNA data that distant relatives of his had submitted to a profiling company like 23andMe. And all the big companies are saying, whoop, we don't know anything about this, can't say anything about it. But obviously, law enforcement was able to use that data bank to kind of trace the DNA to this one person and find him years and years after these awful killings and rapes. So it opens this whole box of, well, how do we use this data that all these companies have on people's health?
Wait, if you are a murderer, why would you submit your DNA to one of those companies?
He didn't. It was cousins or aunts or uncles or second cousins, and they were able to string all these people together that had small similarities to the DNA found at the crime scene.
Whoa.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the thing about it. He never consented to have his DNA submitted to this company, but the company knew about him and what his DNA looked like anyway.
Oh, is that legal?
God.
We don't know. We will find out.
By the way, I should have known. There are at least 3 podcasts about the Golden State Killer, according to Time.
Of course.
Case File has done stuff, Criminology, and My Favorite Murder.
My Favorite Murder is a fun show.
Oh, jeez.
That's off color.
Yes. Yeah, very, very, very off color, but fun.
By the way, I've plugged this one before, but be sure to, if you're especially from the Seattle area, listen to Somebody Somewhere. I listened to the finale on my spring break, and it is, let me just say, there's a surprise twist at the end.
I've heard. I waited until the full thing was done to binge listen to it, but I'm going to start once, maybe when I run out of In the Dark, actually.
Yeah, the one, Somebody Somewhere, is about the murder of Thomas Wales, the former assistant U.S. attorney in Queen Anne. All right, on that note.
Cheerful.
Big news week. Thanks for the conversation. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Claire McGrain.
We'll talk to you next time on The Week in Geek.
Thanks for listening to The Week in Geek, GeekWire's weekly news podcast. Follow all of our coverage of tech and science news at geekwire.com and subscribe to our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts.